Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find everything that we do as part of our Learning College at vnnforum.com. You can also find some at alexlinder.com. You can find a complete listing of all the audiobooks, and some of them we've completed, maybe about 10, and some of them are magazine articles, or I should say journal articles, or very long magazine articles, heavy, weighty, good, solid intellectual stuff, the best stuff out there, the stuff you will never be taught in accredited colleges, even if the material itself isn't racialist. I give it the racialist commentary, so I'm both reading you the text from an excellent, insightful author, and I'm giving you the white interpretation of it, if it is not white itself. So let's get right to it today. We've got two more chapters to close out Volume 1. We're going to do them together because they both touch on Jews and Red Russia, Soviet Union, produced by Jewish Bolsheviks. And Henry Ford has said in earlier segments, in earlier chapters that we've taped, and we're doing it pretty much chapter by chapter, and sometimes we take one or two together as we are today. He said that Soviet Union was not possible without 90% of the commissars being Jews. Commissars are sort of the political leaders within the army who are giving everyone else the agenda and driving them on, spurring the goyish beasts to destroy the enemies of the Jewish overlords, as it were. So let's get on. There's an epigraph that's not attributed to anybody. That is a quotation before the chapter and then the chapter itself. But we're going to do 19 and 20. Again, you should know by now, if you've been listening to these, the Unabridged, The International Jew, published over 91 weeks back in 1920-21, series of newspaper articles appearing in the Dearborn Independent, Henry Ford's paper, put out by his researchers, which he had looked into the Jewish question. And these articles are mostly 8 or 9 pages long, pretty uniformly. There are 20 per volume. There are 4 volumes of 20 chapters apiece, making for 80 total chapters. We've made our way through 17 of them, or 18 of them, and we're now going to do 19 and 20 to close out Volume 1. Chapter 19, The All-Jewish Mark on Red Russia. And remember, the Soviet Revolution had been accomplished just a couple years before. This was written in, I believe, September of 1920. So let's read the quote that it starts with. In a world of completely organized territorial sovereignties, he, the Jew, has only two possible cities of refuge. He must either pull down the pillars of the whole national state system, as George Soros would do 100 years later, he must either pull down the pillars of the whole national state system, or he must create a territorial sovereignty of his own. In fact, the Jew chose to do both. Again, written in 1920, 28 years before Israel appeared on the map. In Eastern Europe, Bolshevism and Zionism seem to grow side by side. The Jew supports. Remember, Jews always bet on all horses, so they bet on international raceless, supposedly, communism, but also on Jewish racial nationalism, national socialism for Israel. So they have both solutions, both serving them, both of them hostile to you, white man. In Eastern Europe, Bolshevism and Zionism seem to grow side by side, not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system is ever anything but distasteful to him. No existing Gentile system is ever anything but distasteful to the Jew. And with that begins The All-Jewish Mark on Red Russia, Chapter 19, Volume 1, The Unabridged, The International Jew by Henry Ford, for his researchers at the Dearborn Independent. We shall now briefly interrupt the commentary which we have been making on the protocols to set at rest for once and for all certain misstatements which are made for Gentile consumption. To learn what the Jewish leaders of the United States or any other country think, do not read their addresses to the Gentiles, read their addresses to their own people. On such matters as these, whether the Jew regards himself as destined to rule the world, whether he regards himself as belonging to a nation and race, distinct from every other nation and race, whether he regards the Gentile world as the legitimate field of his exploitation by a lower moral method than is permissible among his own people, whether, that's the dual code, whether he knows and shares the principles of the protocols, on such matters as these, the only safe guide is to be found in the words which Jewish leaders speak to Jews, not in the words they speak to Gentiles. The notable Jewish names which appear oftenest in the press do not represent the spokesmen of Judaism at all, but only a selected few who represent the Department of Propaganda among the Gentiles. I slightly misintoned that. But only a selected few who represent the Department of Propaganda among the Gentiles. And he's capitalized Department of Propaganda among the Gentiles. Sometimes that propaganda is in the form of donations for Christian charitable organizations. Sometimes it is in the form of liberal opinions on religious, social, and political questions. In whatever form it comes, you may depend upon it that the real activities of the Jewish hierarchy proceed under cover of that which the Gentiles invited to observe and approve. The statements offered in this series are never made without the strictest and fullest proof, confirmation and corroboration in the utterances of Jewish leaders. This is one of the strange features of the multitude of Jewish attacks on this series. They are attacking what they themselves stand for, and their only reason for the attack must be their belief that this investigation has not been able to penetrate through to that which has been kept hidden from the world. The most persistent denials have been offered to the statement that Bolshevism everywhere, in Russia or in the United States, is Jewish. In these denials, we have perhaps one of the most brazen examples of the double intent referred to above. The denial of the Jewish character of Bolshevism is made to the Gentile, but in the confidence and secrecy of Jewish communication, or buried in the Yiddish dialect, or obscurely hidden in the Jewish national press, we find the proud assertion made to their own people that Bolshevism is Jewish. Jewish propaganda has only two straws to grasp in the terrible tale of murder, immorality, robbery, enforced starvation, and hideous humanism, which make the present Russian situation impossible to describe and all but impossible to comprehend. One of these straws is that Kerensky, the man who eased in the opening wedge of Bolshevism, is not a Jew. Indeed, one of the strongest indications that Bolshevism is Jewish is that the Jewish press emphasizes so fiercely the alleged gentilism of at least two of the revolutionary notables. It may be cruel to deny them among two hundreds, but merely saying so cannot change Kerensky's nationality. His name is Adler. That's a German word meaning eagle, and a common Jew name, like a psychiatrist named Adler. His father was a Jew, and his mother a Jewess. Adler, the father, died, and the mother married a Russian named Kerensky, whose name the young child took. Among the radicals who employed him as a lawyer, among the forces that put him forward to drive the first nail into Russia's cross, among the soldiers who fought with him, his Jewish descent and character have never been doubted. Well, but there is Lenin, our Jewish publicists say. Lenin, head of it all, the brains of it all. Lenin is a Gentile. We've got you there. Lenin is a Gentile. Perhaps he is, but why do his children speak Yiddish? Now, we know that Lenin is a quarter Jew. He's like a grandmother named Blank. Why are his proclamations put forth in Yiddish? Why did he abolish the Christian Sunday and establish by law the Jewish Saturday, Sabbath? The explanation of all this may be that he married a Jewess. The fact is that he did. But another explanation may be that he himself is a Jew. Certainly he is not the Russian nobleman he has always claimed to be. The statements he has made about his identity thus far have been lies. The claim that he is a Gentile may be unfounded, too. No one ever doubted Trotsky's nationality. He is a Jew. His name is Bronstein. Recently, the Gentiles were told that Trotsky had said he wasn't much of anything in religion. That may be. But still, he must be something. Else why are the Russian Christian churches turned into stables, slaughterhouses, and dancing halls, while the Jewish synagogues remain untouched? And why are Christian priests and ministers made to work on roads, while Jewish rabbis are left their clerical privileges? Trotsky may not be much of anything in religion, but he is a Jew, nevertheless. This is not mere Gentile insistence that he shall be considered a Jew, whether or no. It is straight Jewish teaching that he is. In a future discussion on religion or race, we shall show that even without religion, Trotsky is, and is considered by all Jewish authorities, to be a Jew. So Ford directly puts the lie to the common conservative claim. Oh, that was atheists that overthrew Russia. Well, Jews had nothing to do with it. Jews aren't the same thing as atheists, but every rabbi ever existed. You can be an atheist and a Jew because a Jew is a member of a race, a blood group. It's not merely some obnoxious codes that are called a religion. An apology must be made here for repeating well-known facts. Yet so many people are not even aware now of the true meaning of Bolshevism that at the risk of monotony, we shall cite a few of the salient facts. The purpose, however, is not alone to explain Russia, but to throw a warning light on conditions in the United States. The Bolshevik government, as it stood late this summer when the latest report was smuggled through to certain authorities, shows up the Jewish domination of the whole affair. It has changed very slightly since the beginning. We give only a few items to indicate the proportion. It must not be supposed that the non-Jewish members of the government are Russian. Very few Russians have anything to say about their own country these days. The so-called dictatorship of the proletariat, in which the proletariat has nothing whatsoever to say, is Russian only in the sense that it is set up in Russia. It is not Russian in that it springs from or includes the Russian people. It is the international program of the protocols, which might be put over by a minority in any country, and which is being given a dress rehearsal in Russia. And then they've got a rare graphic, the first one we've come across, table showing Jewish control of Russia. And they have a number of commissariats and the percentage of Jews in them, so we see, like, Council of the Commissaries of the People, number of members, number of Jewish members, Jewish percentage, and they show over about a dozen categories that Jews, I'll just read them off, 77, 76, 81, 80, 95, 79, 100, 87, 100, 91, 100, journalist, commissaries of the provinces, delegates of the Bolshevik Red Cross to Berlin, Vienna, Varsovia, Bucharest, Copenhagen, the Commissariat of Work, the Commissariat of Social Assistance, the Commissariat of Public Instruction, the Commissariat of Justice, the Commissariat of Finance, of Foreign Affairs, of War, of the People. So all of these, none of them are less than three-quarters Jews in all these commissariats and these leadership groups. I won't read the other specific figures because they all have typically 25, 10, 50, 40, 45 members, and the vast, more than three-quarters of all of them, every single one, are Jews. So that right there tells you that the Russian Bolshevik Revolution is completely Jewish in nature, origin, execution, and administration. Period. End of sentence. Case closed. There is no counter-argument. These are enlightening figures, says Ford. The reader will note that the Jewish percentage is high at all times, never lower than 76% in any case. Curiously enough, the lowest percentage of Jews is found in the Commissariat of War. But in those committees which deal most closely with the mass of the people, as well as in the committees of defense and propaganda, Jews fill literally all the places. Remember what the protocols say about press control. Remember what Baron Montefiore said about it. And then look at the government journalists. That committee comprises 41 men, and the 41 are Jews. Only Jewish pens are trusted with Bolshevik propaganda. And then the so-called Red Cross delegates, which are merely Red Revolutionary delegates to the cities named. Of the eight, there are eight Jews. The Commissariat of Social Assistance, upon whose word the life and privilege of tens of thousands hang, there are six members, and the six are Jews, and so on through the list. Out of the 53 members of the Commissariat of Public Instruction, 11 are noted as non-Jews, but what kind of non-Jews is not stated. They may be non-Jews like Lenin, whose children speak Yiddish as their native tongue. Whatever they are, there is a sidelight upon their attitude in the fact that the Bolsheviki immediately took over all the Hebrew schools and continued them as they were laid down, as they were, and laid down a rule that the ancient Hebrew language should be taught in them. The ancient Hebrew language is the vehicle of the deeper secrets of the world program. That's very telling and interesting. And for the Gentile Russian children? Why, said these gentle Jewish educators, we will teach them sex knowledge. We will brush out of their minds the cobwebs. They must learn the truth about things, with consequences that are too pitiable to narrate. But this can be said. Unquestionably, there were deaths among innocent Jews when Hungary wrested itself free from the red Bolshevism of Bela Kun, or Cohen. The Jews may well call it the White Terror that followed their failure to reenact the tragedy of Russia and Hungary. But there are mountains of evidence to show that nothing had so potent an effect in producing the bloodshed of the White Terror as the outraged minds of parents whose children had been compulsorily drawn through sloughs of filth during the short time the Jewish Bolsheviki had charge of the schools. So always, and again, this is pre-Frankfurt, the Jews always seek sex direct to pollute and poison the minds of young Goyim in order to get them destroy their character, and through that destroy their family and destroy society and wreck the nation to deliver the nation into Jewish hands. American Jews do not like to hear this. Their shrinking from it would be greatly to their honor did they not immediately return to the defense of the people who do these things. It is well enough known that the chastity of Christians is not so highly regarded by the Orthodox male Jew as is the chastity of his own people. But it would be pleasant to be certain that all of them condemn what went on in Russia and Hungary in the matter of education. However, as most of the influences which destroy Gentile youth today in America are in the hands of the Jews, and as it is plainly stated in the protocols that one of the lines of campaign is, quote, to corrupt the youth of the Gentiles, the situation is one that calls for something more than mere hard feelings and angry denials whenever these facts are referred to. It is not the economic experiment, so-called, that one objects to in Russia. It is not the fallacies, the sad delusion of the people. No, it is the downright dirty immorality, the brutish nastiness of it all, and the line which the immorality and nastiness draws between Jew and Gentile, the horrible cruelty involved we will not deal with, leaving it merely with the explanation which has found utterance in the Jewish press that, quote, it may be that the Jew in Russia is taking an unconscious revenge for his centuries of suffering. And isn't that funny? Always, there's never any admission Jews do things wrong. Jews never hate. Jews self-hate. Oh, if Jew does something that might be taken as really vicious, cruel, or nasty, or undeserved to someone, unjust to someone else, why, the Jew is taking it unconscious. Jews are never conscious of what they do. And then you have fools on our side talking about Jewish self-deceit, which is just another way of making an excuse for them. They don't deceive themselves. They know exactly what they're doing. Always, all of his anti-Gentilism, his anti-Gentile actions are completely purposive, completely understood, completely rationally intended, the consequences of them. And yet we have all this verbalizing that, well, maybe the Jew is unconscious, maybe the Jew is deceiving himself, maybe he's a self-hating Jew, but he's never do we hear about the other hating Jew, the Lachsism, the anti-Gentilism that motivates the Jew's every thought, word, and action. Never do we hear about those things. But they're real. They're defining. They determine what goes on. It's utterly ridiculous. But asks, so anyway, we heard, so the people in Russia and Hungary really objected to the Jews immoralizing their children, trying to destroy them morally through what they call sex education. That, of course, is not education. It's just garbage propaganda. And it really made them angry. More angry, he says, than anything else. And he says, we're going to leave aside the rest. And then he quotes someone in the Jew press, it may be that the Jew in Russia is taking an unconscious revenge for his centuries of suffering. But, asks some reader, how may we know that all this is true? Bearing in mind that we are speaking of Russia, not for the interest of the Russian situation at all, but to indicate the international character of those who are responsible for the conditions there, and to identify them for the protection of the United States, we shall look at the evidence. There is, of course, the evidence brought to light by our own United States Senate and printed in a report of the Committee on the Judiciary. We do not wish to spend much time on this because we prefer in these articles to use Jewish testimony instead of Gentile, but we shall pause long enough to show the nature of the testimony brought out by our own government. Dr. George A. Simons, S-I-M-O-N-S, a clergyman in charge of an American congregation in Petrograd at the time the Bolshevik terror broke out, was a witness. Parts of his testimony are given here. Quote from Dr. George A. Simons. There were hundreds of agitators who followed in the trail of Trotsky-Bronstein, these men having come over from the Lower East Side of New York. A number of us were impressed by the strange Yiddish element in this thing right from the start, and it soon became evident that more than half the agitators in the so-called Bolshevik movement were Jewish. Senator Nelson, Hebrews? They were Hebrews, apostate Jews. I do not want to say anything against the Jews as such. I am not in sympathy with the anti-Semitic movement, never have been and do not ever expect to be. But I have a firm conviction that this thing is Yiddish and that one of its bases is found in the east side of New York. Senator Nelson, Trotsky came over from New York during that summer, did he not? Dr. Simons, he did. Later, Dr. Simons said, in December 1918, under the presidency of a man known as Apfelbaum, German that would be apple tree, out of 388 members, only 16 happened to be real Russians, and all the rest Jews, with the exception possibly of one man who is a Negro from America, who calls himself Professor Gordon, and 265 of this northern commune government that is sitting in the old Smolny Institute came from the Lower East Side of New York, 265 of them. I might mention this, that when the Bolsheviki came into power, all over Petrograd we had at once a predominance of Yiddish proclamations, big posters, and everything in Yiddish. It became very evident that now was to be one of the great languages, that now that was to be one of the great languages of Russia, Yiddish, and the real Russians, of course, did not take very kindly to it. William Chapin Huntington, who was commercial attaché of the United States Embassy at Petrograd, testified, "The leaders of the movement, I should say, are about two-thirds Russian Jews. The Bolsheviks are internationalists, and they were not interested in the particular national ideals of Russia." William H. Welch, an employee of the National City Bank, New York, testified, "In Russia it is well known that three-fourths of the Bolshevik leaders are Jewish. There were some, not many, but there were some real Russians, and what I mean by real Russians is Russian-born and not Russian Jews." Roger E. Simmons, trade commissioner connected with the United States Department of Commerce, also testified. An important anonymous witness, whom the committee permitted to withhold his name, told the same things. The British White Book, Russia Number 1, A Collection of Reports on Bolshevism in Russia, presented to Parliament by command of His Majesty, April 1919, contains masses of the same testimony from many sources, all of them eyewitnesses. In that very highly respected magazine, Asia, for February-March 1920, is an article which contains, among other important ones, these statements. The italics are ours. In all the Bolshevist institutions, the heads are Jews. The assistant commissar for elementary education, Grunberg, can hardly speak Russian. The Jews are successful in everything and obtain their ends. They know how to command and get complete submission. But they are proud and contemptuous toward everyone, which strongly excites the people against them. At the present time, there is a great national religious fervor among the Jews. They believe that the promised time of the rule of God's elect on earth is coming. They have connected Judaism with a universal revolution. They see in the spread of revolution the fulfilling of the scriptures. Though I make an end of all the nations, whither I have scattered thee, yet I will not make an end of thee. Now, if Gentile proof were wanted, the files of the Dearborn Independent for a whole year would not begin to contain it. But Jewish proof is better. There has been a strange vacillation in Jewish opinion concerning Bolshevism. At first it was hailed with delight. There was no concealment whatever in the early days of the new regime as to the part Jewry had in it. Public meetings, interviews, special articles poured forth in which the very very valuable elements of truth were mingled. There was no attempt at concealment of names. Then the horror of the thing began to take hold upon the world, and for just a breathing space, Jewish opinion fell silent. There was a spasmodic denial or two. Then a new burst of glorification. The glorification continues within Judaism itself, but it now carries on the Gentile side of its face a very sad expression labeled persecution. You're real one-eyed Jack, Dad, but I seen the other side of your face. We have lived to see the day when to denounce Bolshevism is to, quote, persecute the Jews. In the American Hebrew for September 10th, 1920, an article appears which not only acknowledges and explains the part which Jews played in the present unrest and upheaval, but justifies it, and justifies it, curiously enough, by the Sermon on the Mount. The writer says that, quote, the Jew evolved organized capitalism with its working instrumentality, the banking system. This is a very refreshing in view of the numerous Jewish denials of this economic fact. One of the impressive phenomena of the impressive time is the revolt of the Jew against the Frankenstein that his own mind conceived and his own hand fashioned. If this is true, why is Jewish organized capital with its working instrumentality, the banking system, supporting this revolt? That achievement, referring to the Russian overthrow, destined to figure in history as the overshadowing result of the World War, was largely the outcome of Jewish thinking, of Jewish discontent, of Jewish effort to reconstruct. This rapid emergence of the Russian Revolution from the destructive phase and its entrance into the constructive phase is a conspicuous expression of the constructive genius of Jewish discontent. End quote. This, of course, requires proof that the constructive phase has appeared. The implication here is sheer propaganda. The protocols, however, have a reconstructive program. We have not reached it as yet in this series of articles, but it is clearly outlined in the protocols. Destroy the Gentile society, and then reconstruct it according to our... Now read carefully. What Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia, the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind and heart are tending to promote in other countries. Read that again. What Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia, just what was that? And just how did it powerfully contribute? And why are Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent always linked together? If you read the protocols, it is all very clear. Jewish idealism is the destruction of Gentile society and the erection of Jewish society. That's a powerful and important summary point. Jewish idealism is the destruction of Gentile society and the erection of Jewish society. Was it not so in Russia? Yiddish proclamations on the walls, the ancient Hebrew in the schools, Saturday substituted for Sunday, and the rabbis respected while the priests were put to work in the roads, all powerfully contributed to by murder, rapine, theft, and starvation. Excellent writing there. I think that's very nice aperçu or summation. Our author is more candid than he realizes. He calls this linked idealism and discontent, quote, the historic qualities of the Jewish mind. The Dearborn Independent is indebted to him for this clear confirmation of what it has been saying for some time. But even that is not all. Quote, these same historic qualities of the Jewish mind, which contributed so powerfully to accomplish in Russia the Red Terror, still existing there, are declared by this author to be tending to promote the same sort of thing in other countries. He says so in so many words, quote, tending to promote in other countries. But we knew that. The only difference is that when Gentiles said it, they were overwhelmed with the wildest abuse. But now a pro-Jewish writer says it in a leading Jewish publication, and he says it apologetically. Listen to him. Quote, it was natural that discontent in other parts of the world should find expression in overemphasis of issues and overstatement of aims. What discontent? Jewish discontent, of course. Discontent with what? With any form of Gentile rule. And how did it find expression? an overemphasis of issues and overstatement of aims. What were these issues and aims? To bring the Bolshevik Revolution to the United States. No, they did not overstate their aims. They exactly stated them. They simply selected the wrong country, that's all. There are Russian Bolsheviks in this country now hawking about the streets of New York the gold cigarette cases which they stole from Russian families and the family jewels, the wedding and birthday rings, which they filched from Russian women. Bolshevism never got further than the pawn shop and burglar's fence idea. The proof of this traffic in stolen property is going to drive some people into hiding before long. It will be a long, long time before America will be taking orders in Yiddish or American women will be giving up their jewels to the chosen race, in quotes. However, that happens to be only the most recent acknowledgement that has come to hand. It is significant for its confession that, quote, Jewish discontent was, quote, tending to promote, quote, in other countries, what it has so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia. And with such a link between the American Hebrew, Russian Bolshevism, and the protocols, there are still Jewish publicists with a crust to say that only crazy people could see the connection. That is, crust, say, chutzpah. Only blind people will not see it. But that is a minor connection. This series of articles does not rest on anything so accidental as the Jewish New Year's apology for Bolshevism in the Great Hebrew Weekly of the United States. And when he says apology, he means defense, not apology in the way we normally think of it. And so that concludes chapter 19. As I said, we're going to do both of them together, 19 and 20, to close out number 1, because the next one concerns Bolshevism also. Anyway, chapter 19 we just got done with was in the Dearborn Independent and published on 25th of September, 1920. So, chapter 20 will be Jewish testimony in favor of Bolshevism, to nail down that Bolshevism is Jewish in origin and character, and Jews defend it as Judaism. Bolshevism and Judaism are the same thing. The erection of a Jewish system that benefits only Jews and is horrifyingly murderous for non-Jews, for whites. But it begins with an epigraph, which is a series of quotations from an article in the American Hebrew, September 10th, 1920, so probably about 2 weeks before it is quoted in the Dearborn Independent article series. Here are the quotes. Out of the economic chaos, the discontent of the Jew-evolved organized capital with its working instrumentality, the banking system. Next quote. One of the impressive phenomena of the impressive time is the revolt of the Jew against the Frankenstein, which his own mind conceived and his own hand fashioned. That achievement, Russian Bolshevik Revolution, editor, destined to figure in history as the overshadowing result of the World War, so the main thing to come out of the World War is this Jewish communist takeover of Russia, was largely the outcome of Jewish thinking, of Jewish discontent, of Jewish effort to reconstruct. What Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia, the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind and heart are tending to promote in other countries. Shall America, like the Russia of the Tsars, overwhelm the Jew with a bitter and baseless reproach of being a destroyer, and thus put him in the position of an irreconcilable enemy? Or shall America avail itself of Jewish genius as it avails itself of the peculiar genius of every other race? That is the question for the American people to answer, and doesn't that sound like a threat? That closes out the epigraph, the quotations from an article in the American Hebrew, September 10th, 1920. Chapter begins, Jewish Testimony in Favor of Bolshevism is the title of the chapter. The American people will answer that question, and their answer will be against the disruptive genius of dissatisfied Jews. It is very well known that what Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia, that's a quote, is also being attempted in the U.S. Why did not the writer in the American Hebrew say the United States, instead of saying, quote, the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind and heart are tending to promote in other countries. Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent, in quotes, are not directed against capital. Capital is enlisted in their service. The only governmental order the Jewish effort is directed against is Gentile governmental order, and the only capital it attacks is Gentile capital. Lord Eustace Percy, who, if one may judge by the full and appreciative quotations of his words in the Jewish press, has the sanction of thinkers among the Jews, settles the first point. Discussing the Jewish tendency to revolutionary movements, he says, "In Eastern Europe, Bolshevism and Zionism often seem to grow side by side, just as Jewish influence molded Republican and Socialist thought throughout the 19th century down to the Young Turk Revolution in Constantinople hardly more than a decade ago. Not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker of Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is ever anything but distasteful to him." And that analysis is absolutely true. In Russia, the excuse was the Tsar. In Germany, the Kaiser. In England, it is the Irish question. In the numerous South American revolutions, where the Jews have always had a ruling hand, no particular reason was thought necessary to be given. In the United States, it is the capitalistic class, but always and everywhere it is, by confession of their own spokesman, a distaste for any form whatsoever of Gentile government. The Jew believes that the world is his by right. He wants to collect his own, and the speediest way of doing so is the destruction of order by revolution, a destruction which is made possible by a long and clever campaign of loose and destructive ideas. As to the second point, every reader can verify the fact from his own experience. Let him recall to his mind the capitalists who have been held up to public scorn in the Jew-controlled press of the United States, and whom does he find them to be? Whose forms have you seen caricatured with the dollar mark in Hearst's papers? Are they Seligman, Kahn, Warburg, Schiff, Kuhn, Loeb and company? Or any of the others? No, these are Jewish bankers. The attack is never made on them. The names made most familiar to you by newspaper denunciation are the names of Gentile industrial and banking leaders, and Gentile leaders only, the principal ones being Morgan and Rockefeller. And today that would be the Koch brothers. It's okay to abuse them because they're goyim. Whereas it's never okay to go after Soros or any of the Jews, or to even point out that they're Jews. It is a well-known fact that during the French Commune, when men of wealth suffered severe losses in property, the Jewish Rothschilds were not injured to the extent of one penny's worth. It is also a well-known fact, capable of proof satisfactory to any ordinary mind, that the connections between Jewish financiers and the more dangerous revolutionary elements here in the United States are such that it is most unlikely that the former stand to lose anything in any event. Under cover of the disorder in Russia at the present time, Jewish financiers are taking advantage of the stress of the people to gain control of all the strategic natural resources and municipal property, by methods which they fully expect to be legalized by Jewish courts when the present Bolshevik regime announces that it will give way to a, quote, modified communism. The world hasn't seen the end of Bolshevism yet. Like the World War, Bolshevism cannot be interpreted until it is seen who profits most by it, and the profiteering is in full sway now. The enemy is Gentile capital, not any other. And all the wealth of the world is in our hands is the unspoken slogan of every Jewish outbreak in the world today. The quotation at the head of this article represents the position which the Jews are now ready to take with reference to the Russian Revolution. They have always been charged with responsibility for what has occurred in that unhappy country, but at first their spokesman denied it. The denials were most indignant and were usually accompanied by the typical plaint that the charge was persecution. But the facts have been so overwhelming and the government investigations have been so revealing that denials have been abandoned. For a while, an attempt was made to distract attention from Russia by a tremendously powerful propaganda concerning the Jews in Poland. There are many indications that the Polish propaganda was undertaken as a cover for the immense immigration of Jews into the United States. It may be that some of our readers do not know it, but an endless stream of the most undesirable immigrants pours daily into the United States. Tens of thousands of the same people whose presence has been the problem and the menace of governments in Europe. And remember, this is written in 1920, 4 years before the Immigration and Nationality Act, where it reserved new immigrants to the stock of their kind already in the country in order to retain the Northwestern European character of the nation racially. But Jews, of course, are not interested. They don't respect, as he's saying here, they don't respect Goyish government. So they're certainly not going to follow the laws. They'll bitch and bitch that they don't have the formal law that they want, which they finally did succeed in getting put through in 1965, 41 years later, 4 decades later. But even if a law that is pro-Goy, pro-white, pro-European, pro-American exists, that doesn't mean they're going to follow it. Just as we see today when they're jamming all these people into countries and their papers are defending illegal aliens and saying that the law doesn't matter. There's no person is illegal. It's their propaganda cant. Well, the Polish propaganda and the immigration movement are sailing along smoothly, and the United States government is assured by the Jewish ring at Washington that everything is quiet along the Potomac. It is quiet there, quiet as the Jewish ring could wish, but still the Russian fact persists in calling for explanation. And here is the explanation. The Jews created capitalism, we are told. But capitalism has proved itself ill-behaved. So now the Jewish creators are going to destroy their creation. They have done so in Russia. And now, will the American people be good and let their Jewish benefactors do the same here in America? That is the new explanation, and typically Jewish again, it is coupled with a proposal for the United States and a threat. If America refuses this particular service of the Jew, we, quote, put him in a position of an irreconcilable enemy. See the quotation at the head of the article. But the Jews have not destroyed capitalism in Russia. When Lenin and Trotsky make their farewell bow and retire under the protective influence of the Jewish capitalists of the world, it will be seen that only Gentile or Russian capital has been destroyed, and the Jewish capital has been enthroned. What is the record? Documents printed by the United States government contain this letter. Please note the date, the Jewish banker, and the Jewish names. Stockholm, September 21st, 1917. To Mr. Raphael Scholan, S-C-H-O-L-A-N. Dear Comrade, the banking house M. Warburg opened an account for the enterprise of Comrade Trotsky upon receipt of a telegram from the chairman of the Rhine-Westphalian Syndicate. A lawyer, probably Mr. Kestroff, obtained ammunition and organized the transportation of same, together with that of the money, to whom the sum demanded by Comrade Trotsky is to be handed. Fraternal greetings, Furstenberg. So you see that the greatest financial houses are operating hand in hand with the lowest, scummiest, most violent revolutionaries. Warburg and Trotsky are a team. And the opposing team is you, normal whites. Long before that, an American Jewish financier was supplying the funds which carried revolutionary propaganda to thousands of Russian prisoners of war in Japanese camps. It is sometimes said, by way of explaining the Bolshevik movement, that it was financed from Germany, a fact which was seized upon to supply war propaganda. Again, the idiot Anglo-Saxons and the patriotard type repeat this lie that Germany is responsible. And they always ignore the Jew and they always emphasize the German, just as they now emphasize the new German, the Muslim, because it's safe. And the patriotards are above all things gutless, followers, whiners, anti-intellectuals. They don't believe that logic and studying things can lead you to any credible conclusion. They put their faith in faith. And faith fails. Faith doesn't work. Faith is at the root of being dominated by people who don't have faith, but who have, or they place their faith in reason, rationality, and group loyalty, rather than blind subservience to leaders who aren't even of the same race, don't even have a plausible agenda. It is true that part of the money came from Germany. It is true that part of the money came from the United States. It is the whole truth that Jewish finance in all the countries was interested in Bolshevism as an all-Jewish investment. For the whole period of the war, the Jewish World Program was cloaked under this or that national name, the blame being laid on the Germans by the Allies, and on the Allies by the Germans, and the people kept in ignorance of who the real personages were. Again, he uses Disraeli's personages there. The world is governed behind the scenes by very different personages than it supposes. And unless you've seen that, you don't realize that. You're not likely to realize that. It was stated by a French official that $2 million of money was contributed by one Jewish banker alone. When Trotsky left the U.S. to fulfill his appointed task, he was released from arrest at Halifax upon the request of the United States, and everyone knows who constituted the war government of the United States. The conclusion, when all the facts are considered, is irresistible that the Bolshevik Revolution was a carefully groomed investment on the part of international Jewish finance. It is easy to understand, then, why the same forces would like to introduce it to the United States. The real struggle in this country is not between labor and capital. The real struggle is between Jewish capital and Gentile capital. With the IWW, the Wobblies leaders, the socialist leaders, the red leaders, and the labor leaders, almost a unit on the side of the Jewish capitalists. Again, recall which financiers these men most attack. You cannot recall a single Jewish name. The main purpose in these two articles, however, is to introduce the Jewish testimony which exists as to the Jewish nature of Bolshevism. The Jewish nature of Bolshevism. The Jewish Chronicle of London said in 1919, "There is much in the fact of Bolshevism itself, in the fact that so many Jews are Bolsheviks, in the fact that the ideals of Bolshevism at many points are consonant with the finest ideals of Judaism." In the same paper of 1920 is a report of an address made by Israel Zangwill, a noted Jewish writer, in which he pronounced a glowing praise on, quote, "the race which has produced a Beaconsfield, a Reading, a Montague, a Klotz, a Kurt Eisner, a Trotsky." And that was the guy who came up with the he wrote a play, The Melting Pot, I believe it was, or The Crucible, or no, it was The Melting Pot, that introduced that phrase in the American lexicon, I believe, right around 1900. That's the same Israel Zangwill. Sort of a proto-diversity or multiculturalism that his fellow Jews, Horace Kallan, was coming up with multiculturalism around that same time, which would later evolve into today's diversity, etc. Mr. Zangwill, in his swelling Semitic enthusiasm, embraced the Jews in the British government in the same category with the Jews of the Hungarian and Russian Bolshevik governments. What is the difference? They are all Jewish and all of equal honor and usefulness to the race. Rabbi J.L. Magnus, M-A-G-N-E-S, in an address at New York in 1919, is reported to have said, quote, "When the Jew gives his thought, his devotion, to the cause of the workers and of the dispossessed, of the disinherited of the world, the radical quality within him goes to the roots of things, and in Germany he becomes a Marx and a LaSalle, a Haas, and an Edward Bernstein. In Austria, he becomes a Victor Adler and a Friedrich Adler. In Russia, a Trotsky. Just take for a moment the present situation in Russia and Germany. The revolution set creative forces free, and see what a large company of Jews was available for immediate service. Socialist revolutionaries and Mensheviki and Bolsheviki, majority and minority socialists, whatever they be called, Jews are to be found among the trusted leaders and the routine workers of all these revolutionary parties. See, says the rabbi, what a large company of Jews are available for immediate service. One ought to see where he points. There are as many Jewish members of revolutionary societies in the United States as there were in Russia. And here, as there, they are, quote, available for immediate service, unquote. Bernard Lazar, a Jewish writer who has published a work on anti-Semitism, says, and that's a very famous work, "The Jew, therefore, does take a part in revolutions, and he participates in them insofar as he is a Jew, or more correctly, insofar as he remains a Jew. So making an identity of Jew and revolutionary. He says also, the Jewish spirit is essentially a revolutionary spirit, and consciously or otherwise, the Jew is a revolutionist. And remember the title of E. Michael Jones's book, The Revolutionary Jew, over 1,000 pages documenting this Jewish revolutionary spirit and the way it seeks to undermine all public morals and goyish political orders. Because, as Ford is saying here in The International Jew, the Jew hates all Gentile governments, and he is only happy when he erects his own Jewish government to rule over us as a dictator without any limitations whatsoever on his power, which is pretty much how it was formulated word for word by one of the communists in Russia, Lenin, I think it was, or means absolute power is what communism means. There's hardly any country in the world, except the United States, where denials of this could be made in such a way as to require proof. In every other country, the fact is known. Here we have been under such a fear of mentioning the word Jew, or anything pertaining to it, that the commonest facts have been kept from us, facts which even a superficial knowledge of Jewish writing would have given us. It was almost a pathetic spectacle to see American audiences go to lectures about the Russian situation and come away from the hall confused and perplexed because the Russian situation is so un-Russian. All because no lecturer thought it politic to mention Jew in the United States for, as someday we shall see, the Jew has contrived to gain control of the platform, too. Not only do the literary lights of the Jewry acknowledge the Jew's propensity to revolution generally, and his responsibility for the Russian situation particularly, but the lower lights also have a very clear idea about it. The Jew in the midst of the revolution is conscious that somehow he is advancing the cause of Israel. He may be a bad Jew in the synagogue sense, but he is enough of a Jew to be willing to do anything that would advance the prestige of Israel. Race is stronger than religion in Jewry. The Russian paper, On to Moscow, in September 1919, said, "It should not be forgotten that the Jewish people, who for centuries were oppressed by kings and czars, are the real proletariat, the real international, like their song, which has no country." Mr. Cohan, in the newspaper Communist, in April 1919, said, "Without exaggeration, it may be said that the great Russian social revolution was indeed accomplished by the hands of the Jews. Would the dark oppressed masses of the Russian workmen and peasants have been able to throw off the yoke of the bourgeoisie by themselves? No, it was precisely the Jews who have led the Russian proletariat to the dawn of the Internationale, and have not only led, but are also now leading the Soviet cause, which remains safe in their hands. We may be quiet as long as the chief command of the Red Army is in the hands of Comrade Leon Trotsky. It is true that there are no Jews in the ranks of the Red Army as far as the privates are concerned, but in the committees and Soviet organizations, the councils, as commissars, the Jews are gallantly leading the masses of the Russian proletariat to victory. It is not without reason that during the elections to all Soviet institutions, the Jews are winning by an overwhelming majority. The symbol of Jewry, which for centuries has struggled against capitalism, has become also the symbol of the Russian proletariat, which can be seen even in the adoption of the red five-pointed star, which in former times, as it is well known, was the symbol of Zionism and Jewry. With this sign comes victory, and with this sign comes the death of the parasites of the bourgeoisie. Jewish tears will come out of them in sweat and drops of blood." This confession, or rather boast, is remarkable for its completeness. "The Jews," says Mr. Cohan, "are in control of the Russian masses who have never risen at all, who only know that a minority, like the Tsar's minority, is in control at the seat of government. The Jews are not in the Red Army," Mr. Cohen informs us, "that is, in the ranks where the actual fighting is done, and this is strictly in line with the protocols. The strategy of the world program is to set Gentiles to kill Gentiles. This was the Jewish boast during the various French social disasters, that so many Frenchmen had been set killing each other. In the world war just passed, there were as many Gentiles killed by Gentiles as there are Jews in the world. It was a great victory for Israel. Jewish tears will come out of them in sweat of drops of blood. But the Jews are in the places of control and safety, says Mr. Cohan, and he is absolutely right about it. The wonder is that he was so honest as to say it. As to the election, so-called, at which the Jews are so unanimously chosen, the literature of Bolshevism is very explicit. Those who voted against the Jewish candidates were adjudged enemies of the revolution and executed. It did not require many executions at a voting place to make all the elections unanimous. Mr. Cohan is especially instructive on the significance of the Red Star, the five-pointed emblem of Bolshevism. The symbol of Jewry, he says, has become also the symbol of the Russian proletariat. The Star of David, the Jewish national emblem, is a six-pointed star formed by two triangles, one standing on its base, the other on its apex. Deprived of their baselines, these triangles approximate the familiar Masonic emblem of the square and compass. It is this Star of David of which a Jewish observer in Palestine remarks that there are so few among the graves of the British soldiers who won Palestine in the recent war. Most of the signs are the familiar wooden cross. These crosses are now reported to be objectionable to the new rulers of Palestine because they are so plainly in view of the visitor who approaches the new Jewish university. As in Soviet Russia, so in Palestine, not many Jews laid down their lives for the cause. There were plenty of Gentiles for that purpose. As the Jew is a past master in the art of symbolism, it may not be without significance that the Bolshevik star has one point less than the Star of David. For there is still one point to be fulfilled in the world program as outlined in the protocols, and that is the enthronement of our leader. When he comes, the world autocrat for whom the whole program is framed, the sixth point may be added. The 5 points of the star, now apparently assured, are the purse, the press, the peerage, Palestine, and proletarianism. The sixth point will be the Prince of Israel. It is very hard to say, it is hard to believe, but Mr. Cohan has said it, and revolutions, especially since the French Revolution, confirm it, that, quote, with this sign comes the death of the parasites of the bourgeoisie, dot, dot, dot. Jewish tears will come out of them in sweat of drops of blood. The bourgeoisie, as the protocols say, are always Gentile. The common counterargument to the invincible fact of the Jewish character of the Russian Revolution, an argument which is destined to disappear now that Jewish acknowledgement is coming thick and fast, is that the Jews in Russia suffer too. How can we favor a movement which makes our own people suffer? Is an argument put up to the Gentile. Well, the fact is this, they are favoring that movement. Today, this very moment, the Bolshevik government is receiving money from Jewish financiers in Europe, and if in Europe, then of course from the international Jewish bankers in America also. That is one fact. Another fact is this, the Jews of Russia are not suffering to anywhere near the extent we are told by the propagandists. It is now a fact admitted by Jews themselves that upon the first sweep of the Bolshevists across Poland, the Polish Jews were friendly with the invaders and helped them. Yeah, Donald Day talks about that. Maybe not in Poland, but in the in Poland, but also in the other countries, Eastern Europe and the Russians swept in. They were greeted by the Jews as liberators, while they were hated by the natives. The fact was explained by American Jews in this manner. Since Bolshevism came to Russia, the condition of the Jews there has greatly improved. Therefore, the Polish Jews were friendly. And it is true, the condition of Russian Jews is good. One reason is, they have Russia. Everything there belongs to them. The other reason is, the Jews of Russia are the only ones receiving help there today. Did that second statement ever strike you as significant? Only the Jews of Russia have food and money sent to them. It is one form, of course, of the support which the Jewish world is giving Bolshevism. But if the suffering among the Jews is what the propagandists say it is, what must it be among the Russians? Yet no one is sending food or money to them. The probable truth of the whole situation is that Jewish Bolshevism is laying a tax on the world. Any time it may be required, there is plenty of evidence as to the good condition of the Jews in Russia. They have all that there is. Another source of confusion is revealed in the question, how can Jewish capitalists support Bolshevism when Bolshevism is against capitalism? Bolshevism, as stated before, is only against Gentile capitalism. Jewish financiers who remain in Russia are very useful to the Bolsheviki. Read this description by an eyewitness. A Jew is this commissary of the bank, very elegant, with a cravat of the latest style and a fancy waistcoat. A Jew is this district commissary, former stockbroker, with a double bourgeois chin. Again a Jew, this inspector of taxes. He understands perfectly how to squeeze the bourgeoisie. These agents of Jewry are still there. Other agents are among the Russians who fled, getting their lands away from them on mortgage loans. When the curtain lifts, most of the choice real estate will have been found to pass into Jewish control by perfectly legal, in quotes, means. That is one answer to the question, why the Jewish capitalists supported Bolshevism. The Red Revolution is the greatest speculative event in human history. Besides, it is for the exaltation of Israel. It is a colossal revenge which the Jews always take where they can for wrongs real or imaginary. Jewish capitalism knows exactly what it is doing. What are its gains? One, it has taken a whole rich country without the cost of war. Two, it has demonstrated the necessity of gold. Jewish power rests on the fiction that gold is wealth. By the premeditated clumsiness of the Bolshevik monetary system, the unthinking world has been made to believe still more strongly that gold is necessary, and this belief gives Jewish capitalism another hold upon the Gentile world. If the Bolshevists had been honest, they could have dealt Jewish capitalism its death blow. No, gold is still on the throne. Destroy the fiction that gold has value, and you leave the Jewish international financiers sitting forlorn on heaps of useless metal. Three, it has demonstrated its power to the world. And I think that's foolish. There's no way, yeah, gold is inherently valueless, but you could say that about anything. You know, all of this has value in relation to human need, and humans need something that has the characteristics that gold pretty much alone has for transferring value and storing value. So gold has been accepted as value store and currency for transfer for thousands of years, and it doesn't have anything to do with Jews. So he's simply wrong about this. Three, it has demonstrated its power to the world. Protocol 7 says, to demonstrate our enslavement of the Gentile governments of Europe, we will show our power to one of them by crimes of violence, that is, a reign of terror. Has Europe been sufficiently shown? Europe has and is afraid. That is a great gain for Jewish capitalists. Four, not the least of the gains is the field practice in the art of revolution, which Russia has offered. Students of that Red School are coming back to the U.S., The technique of revolution has been reduced to a science according to the details laid down in the protocols. To use Rabbi Magnus's words again, see what a large company of Jews was available for immediate service. The available company is now much larger. And with that closes chapter 20 in volume 1 of The Unabridged, The International Jew. So we see that Jews are proud of their Russian Revolution. It was affected by the radicals in conjunction with their financiers, and it was defended by their press. And yet at the same time, they're such brazen liars that if there appear to be any bad aspects of it, then they're quick to dissociate themselves from it in the media and the material that they prepare for the sucker goyim like us. So, pretty clear what's going on here. Bolshevism is Jewish. It's only against Gentile capital. It's all for Jewish capital. And that's a good statement that the Red Revolution was the greatest speculative event in human history. Think about the Jews are always demanding reparations for what the Nazis did. But they themselves stole Russia blind. And they've never given a penny of it back. They are the real criminals and thieves and political scum. And they need to be put an end to. Well, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again, and we'll do some more of The International Jew real soon. We'll move on to Volume 2.